The National Broadcasting Company presents a special news report from London. You are to hear from the noted journalist and war correspondent, John Gunther. We take you now to London.
Hello, America. This is John Gunther calling from London. Good evening, everybody. This has been a hard day today, a bad day. We've seen something very terrible to watch, the death of a free country, the death of a nation. Poland was, in effect, killed today, assassinated. For the fourth time in its unhappy history, Poland has been partitioned. Of course, the process is not yet finally complete. There's still some fighting, but negotiations are scheduled to take place tonight for the evacuation of Warsaw. The Polish government has already fled. No Polish government exists. To all intents and purposes, the Poland we've known these past 20 years has ceased to be. There are all manner of possible explanations for the sudden invasion of Poland this morning by Soviet Russia. This invasion produced this final disaster. Some of these explanations are very abstruse and complicated, but it seems to me that the simplest explanation is the best. It's that the Russians did not want Germany to obtain all of Poland. They did not want Germany, however well they may be working with Germany at the moment, to become too powerful in the East. They wanted some of Poland, some loot, so to speak, for themselves, and they took it while the taking was good. There's no use denying that this has been a very grave shock indeed to opinion here. Today, almost everyone is pretty lugubrious. Some officials discount the importance of what's happened, but they're all uncomfortable about it. They say that they're not surprised, that they knew it was going to happen. But now that it has happened, they don't like it very much. The Russian invasion of Poland changes everything. We have to take stock all over again. This is a new war now. Whether or not the Russians and Germans are actual allies in the legal sense, they've taken common action against Poland. The conclusion one must draw from this is that, despite the Russian protestation of neutrality, Great Britain and France are, in effect, henceforth fighting not merely Germany, but Russia too. They're fighting not merely Hitlerism, which was quite enough to keep their hands full, but Stalinism also. Even if Russia remains neutral as regards the West, this remains true in a sense because the indirect help that Russia can give Germany is considerable. Already, German troops and airplanes, according to late radio reports, are leaving the Eastern Front and are reinforcing the Germans in the West. The Germans are, it seems, leaving to Russia the job of finally finishing off the Poles. Another point in this connection. The British have justified their lack of direct help to the Poles on the ground that they must conserve all their forces to beat Germany in the West. Then, when victory comes, according to this theory, Germany will collapse and Poland can be resurrected. But, as a very astute friend of mine pointed out today, no one can put forward this theory with any confidence now. To resurrect Poland now means that the British would have to fight Russia after the war with Germany. Britain would have to take on a new enemy, Russia, after the tremendously exhausting struggle that a victory over Germany alone would entail. It must be admitted that all this is a grave blow to the Allies. Likewise, it must be admitted that in more than one particular, it is the Allies' own fault. A lot of bad chickens came home to roost today. The British and the French didn't help Czechoslovakia. They didn't help Spain. They agreed finally to help Poland when they must have known that direct help to Poland would be impossible. They started negotiations with the Soviet Union. They pursued these negotiations with almost inconceivable half-heartedness, dilatoriness, and stupidity. Today, the Russians are paying them back. For years, British policy was to play Germany off against Russia. Now the Russians are playing a bit of power politics themselves. They're playing the Germans off against the British. Now, as to British opinions in official circles tonight. A spokesman indicated that the British view is approximately this. They think that one of two things may happen. They don't know which, and they're waiting to see. The first is that the Russians and Germans are bound by a secret military understanding that they are, in fact, allies, and that they'll proceed to fight the war together as allies. They think that the Russians have determined to divide up Eastern Europe with Germany, and that Germany can continue to count on Russian support and cooperation. The Russian motive, they say, is something that I've often mentioned in these broadcasts. It's that Germany is fighting the Western capitalist world, which is also Russia's chief enemy. Therefore, Russia must inevitably support Germany in what is essentially Russia's fight. The second British theory as to what may happen is almost diametrically opposite. It's that the Russians and Germans don't really like each other and will presently fall out. It's that you can't mix communists and Nazis, no matter how closely they resemble one another superficially, and that the Germans will not in any circumstances permit Russian troops to help them closely. Stalin and Hitler, the British say, are bound to quarrel, if only over division of the spoils. Stalin and Hitler, they say, cannot possibly continue to work together in harmony. Whichever of these theories will turn out to be correct, the British say that they're quite sure of one other thing. Namely, that Russian military strength has been exaggerated, that the Russians are in no position to fight any comprehensive war outside their own territory, or even to give substantial help to Germany economically. Of course, this may be an example of what is known as whistling in the dark. The British are, you know, pledged to come to the support of Poland if Poland thinks that her independence is threatened and if Poland fights to preserve it. Oddly enough, this pledge, this famous pledge made in March, does not mention by name the possible aggressive. At that time, it was assumed beyond doubt that the aggressor would be Germany. No one dreamed that the aggressor against Poland would be Soviet Russia. After all, it was the Russians who were supposed to be the chief bulwark against fascism in Europe, against war, against aggression. But now the Russians, as well as the Germans, have certainly threatened the independence of Poland, to put it mildly, and the Poles have replied by military action. So it would seem the British are bound to come to the support of the Poles against the Soviet Union, just as they were bound to come to the defense of the Poles against Germany. So, a good many people thought early today the Soviet invasion of Poland would mean that the British would have to step in and declare war on the Soviet Union. This has not happened. And we learned tonight from extremely qualified sources it's not going to happen. According to all present indications, the British are not going to declare war on Russia. They're not going to declare war on the Soviet Union. The way is made clear for the British to take this course by two factors. First, Poland is no longer considered to be an independent state. It has ceased to exist. Therefore, the pledge does not apply. Second, the Russians, who don't want a war with Britain any more than Britain wants a war with the Soviet Union, have very carefully provided a loophole for the British by declaring that they are neutral. The word neutral seems odd. The Russians sent messages to 24 countries this morning, every country with whom they have relations except Poland, announcing and underlying their neutrality. It's fantastic, of course, but this is a fantastic war in what seems to be a fantastic world. I've mentioned the two alternatives that British spokesmen envisage tonight. They're the same alternatives that I suggested a few evenings ago. At that time, I mentioned a third possibility. It is that the Germans may be using the Russians to buttress their offer of peace, their peace offensive, if they make a peace offensive. Official circles tonight are inclined to minimize this. They're not sure that the Germans will make a peace offer after all. The Germans, they think, are too intoxicated by their Polish success. If there is no peace offensive, then, of course, there will be a war offensive. The Germans may very well strike toward Romania. This is another reason why the British have decided not to declare war on Russia. They think that they will be in a better position to support Romania and other countries in southeastern Europe if Russia does remain neutral as far as Britain is concerned. A declaration of war by Britain on Russia, it's explained, quote, would needlessly provoke the Russians, unquote. This is strange language, I admit, and bring Russia in full force on the side of Germany. One other point interests everyone tonight, whether the Germans, with Russian collaboration, will set up a puppet state in Poland, or, on the other hand, will establish a common frontier with Russia. The Germans, it's generally believed, prefer the idea of a puppet Poland as a buffer between themselves and the Soviet Union. The Russians, on the other hand, according to good information, would prefer a common frontier with Germany. Good night.
We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company, New York.
You have heard John Gunther, author of Inside Europe and Inside Asia, speaking from London. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Here is Eugene Lyons, editor of American Mercury and author of Assignment in Utopia, which is a story of his experiences as a newsman in Soviet Russia. Here he is with his last-minute views on the Russian invasion of Poland. Mr. Lyons.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You've heard that perhaps as many as 2 million Red Army troops are today advancing across the flatlands and marshes of eastern Poland. They're moving into a bleak, poverty-ridden and unfortunate land. They're plowing down a population of Ukrainians, white Russians and Jews who have not had a moment of real independence in all their history. Until 1914, these people lived under the Nagaika, the whip of Russian Tsarism. During the World War, they were quickly overrun by the Kaiser's armies, and they haven't yet forgotten the brutality of that occupation. Then came the nightmare years of civil wars, when Red Armies and White Armies, Ukrainian hetmen and Polish legions, fought over every juiceless bone of that territory. Finally, in 1921, with the formal end of the Russian-Polish War, they remained under the domination of Warsaw. But the Poles were neither wise nor mild in the treatment of their minority races. Though for centuries they had known what it means to be oppressed themselves, it did not stop them from oppressing in return. They had treated the Ukrainians and the white Russians, and of course the Jews, as conquered peoples. Well, after an absence of 18 years, the Soviet troops are once more moving through this area. It's a high-powered, mechanized invasion, backed by thousands of airplanes and supported by crack regiments of Russian cavalry. It's the largest military action anywhere by the Soviet regime since the end of the Russian civil wars in 1921. Regardless of hypocritical official formulas, it marks Russia's emergence on the larger world stage as an aggressive imperialist power. The land that it's grabbing with the full knowledge and enthusiastic consent of the Nazis used to belong to the old Russia. Just as Hitler is reestablishing the old boundaries of the Kaiser's Germany, so Stalin today began the job of reestablishing the old boundaries of Tsarist Russia. The implications of this move are fairly obvious. If the Kremlin seizes Russia's old holdings in Poland, why not also the rest of what Russia lost? The Bessarabian province of Romania, the Baltic region now split into Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, Finland up north. You can be sure that the entry of the Red Army into Poland has sent shudders of fear down the backs of all these small nations. Russia will continue to insist that despite this large-scale military invasion of a neighboring country, an invasion clearly sanctioned by belligerent Germany, it remains technically neutral. But it's in the war all the same. It's in the war, and its destiny is now tightly linked with the destiny of Nazi Germany. As a matter of fact, England and France have precisely the same legal and moral justification for declaring war on Russia as they had 2 weeks ago for declaring war on Germany. The Anglo-French guarantee to support Poland in the event of aggression by a third nation applies to Russia every bit as much as it applied to Germany. Of course, the Allies are not likely to act on it, for the time being, anyhow. They have too much trouble on their hands as it is. In all but name, however, it seems to me, Stalin's invasion of Poland constitutes a declaration of hostilities against the democratic powers. Let's bear in mind that only the defeat of France and England can ensure Russia's holding permanently what it's now grabbing. Common sense, therefore, shows us that Russia from this point forward has a direct stake in the defeat of the Allies. Germany crashed through the flimsy walls of Poland to liberate the German minority. Russia today crashed on the other side to protect the white Russian and Ukrainian minorities. No one will be fooled by these cynical pretensions except a handful of Hitlerites and Stalinites abroad. What we're witnessing is a struggle for power, for economic wealth, for empire, as primitive and ruthless as any in human history. Under the placating phrases about liberation and protection, there is only one law, the law of the jungle. Certainly the minorities whom Comrade Stalin has nobly undertaken to protect will not appreciate the favor. For some 10 years they have had, as it were, a grandstand seat at the bloody spectacle put on by the Kremlin. They have watched tens of thousands of their countrymen under the Soviet flag trying to escape across the frontiers into Poland, trying to escape from the Stalin terror of forcible collectivization and man-made famine. They have seen these peasant refugees chased by bloodhounds and shot down by Red soldiers. There may be illusions about the Soviet paradise elsewhere in the world. There aren't any among the simple people next door to that paradise. Take the Polish Ukrainians. There are from 5 to 7 millions of them in Poland, about 30 million in Soviet Russia. These Ukrainians hate Poland, detest Germany, and abominate Russia, in about that order. It's no accident that the communist movement, even when it was pretty strong in Poland as a whole, never got a real toehold in the Ukrainian section of Poland. They're mostly a religious people, and they have watched the Soviets destroy the churches in Soviet Ukraine. They are, like farmers and peasants the world over, deeply attached to their private land, poor and barren and exploited though it may be. And they have watched Stalin collectivize their fellow Ukrainians inside Russia with brute force. Soviet Ukraine, it happens, was the scene of the worst terrorism in recent Russian history, the most ruthless as far as scale is concerned, perhaps in modern times. That's where the man-made famine of 1932-33, which killed off from 3 to 5 million men, women, and children, took place. No, I can assure you, on the basis of an intimate acquaintance with that area and those people, that they must be horrified by the arrival of an uninvited protector in the shape of the Red Army. Soviet propagandists have sold the world the idea that minor national groups inside the vast Soviet empire enjoy autonomy. That's the rankest nonsense. It's an autonomy under the bayonets of Comrade Stalin's army and secret police. The faintest expression of nationalist sentiment is instantly drowned in blood. In the last few years, the Kremlin has purged practically all the outstanding leaders of its minority peoples and established an unprecedented centralized control. The much publicized national autonomy, to put the matter briefly, amounts to the right to shout hurrah for Stalin in languages other than Russian. Even today's invasion of Poland is not a new departure for the Soviet regime. Another such invasion took place in 1920. It got as far as the very gates of Warsaw before it was repulsed by the Polish legions under Marshal Pilsudski. The people of Georgia and the Caucasus had set up their own government under a socialist regime, but Trotsky's Red Army marched in and crushed it. The Red Army likewise imposed Moscow domination on Russian Armenian, on the Central Asiatic nationalities, on Outer Mongolia. There's been a lot of wishful thinking, romantic nonsense about Russia spread through the world. The events of these last weeks, climaxed by today's aggression against Poland, will have at least the virtue of clarifying the picture. The world must reckon hereafter with Russia as a part of the totalitarian lineup in every respect. What's more important at this moment, England and France must reckon with Russia as an open enemy. When you stop to analyze Russia's power to hurt England, where it is most vulnerable, in India and the Near East, in the Mohammedan world on one side, and in China on the other, when you stop to analyze that, you realize how serious the blow may be and how far it may be a factor in Hitler's obvious plan to force an early peace on his own terms on the Allies. The most significant repercussions of the Russian aggression may be in the Far East. Only 2 days ago, Japan and Russia declared a truce in their undeclared Mongolian war. Instantly, Japan launched a new offensive in central China, and Russia launched its offensive against the stricken and tottering Poland. That rapprochement between Japan and Russia is only in its initial stage. There is still a chance that Japan may conclude its agreement with England rather than with Russia. But the alternatives now on the eastern horizons are these. Either a totalitarian combination including everything from Germany to the Japanese islands, or a British agreement to permit or even to assist the Japanese conquest of Eastern Asia. The first alternative may spell the doom of the British Empire. The second alternative means the end of British influence in the Far East as the price for saving the rest of the empire.
You have been listening to Eugene Lyons, editor of the American Mercury, noted author and commentator in foreign affairs. This has been another in the series of commentaries on the European situation. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.